Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back, and it is now or never. And, you know, I've been covering for the, you know, past few weeks, as a matter of fact, for a while, I've covered this before regarding sovereign citizens and so forth. The Constitution, when it was drafted, created a new government. It did not retain the laws or the subjugation of people under Britain. As a matter of fact, the Declaration of Independence severed all of those things, severed all of them. So as we started moving forward, we were no longer under the rule. I mean, we had progressed, we evolved from the Magna Carta and the Glorious Bill of Rights as a nation. We evolved, but we did not subjugate us to those things, which is why the states were completely sovereign. And so as we tried this experimentation in the Revolutionary War in forming a union, what we formed was a confederacy. And that confederacy had an association, which we basically created a charter for that, where the sovereigns actually created a compact, not a charter. The difference between a charter and a compact is a compact has multiple parties. A charter is established by a sovereign. The king establishes a charter. The corporation establishes a charter. The state establishes a charter for, you know, allowing something to occur. Whether that be, you know, a charter to go do something, a charter to experiment in something, what have you. And so a charter, you know, by the term in today's vernacular would be inappropriate. In the old days, a charter was very similar to a constitution and very similar to a treaty or what have you. But in today's context, to be very, very clear, the people did not establish the Constitution as a charter. It was a compact because the people didn't do it. The states did it. But let me get back to this evolving thing. So when the states created these sovereign states, how many of the states created a Bill of Rights? Well, many states struggled. And as a matter of fact, Virginia was one that went through a very arduous process of creating a Bill of Rights for the people of Virginia. And in that process is where Madison actually wrote prior to that, or actually it was after, no, it was after the Virginia Bill of Rights that Madison wrote his remonstrance on religion and really started pushing the boundaries even further, that the fact that the state had a direct association with the church basically was, you know, tantamount to what we saw in Europe, there was this direct relationship, and eventually the church started coronating, you know, the leadership or the government. And that's not the direction they wanted to go. And Madison wanted to make sure that we really started moving towards a non-denominational form of government where the government was not favoring one Christian form over another. So that's why I said non-denominational, not secular. See, in today's vernacular, secular means godless. Secular means no religion whatsoever. In other words, it is void of a religion of a supreme being. It is secular, is the religion of man worshiping himself and his own laws. In other words, it's very similar to Luciferianism. Or humanism. And as a matter of fact, humanism is a form of Luciferianism. Anyway, as we keep going, you know, down this path of evolving, well, the associations failed. And so as the association and the end of the war draw to a point, the Articles of Confederation occurred because they knew they needed to do something as far as a union, because they weren't able to pay their debt. So they bolstered up this Continental Congress and gave them a little bit more power, but not the sufficient power necessary. And everybody saw it. It was like the, you know, the big, you know, oozing pimple on the nose of somebody that you just can't keep your eyes off of. I mean, it was just that bad. As a matter of fact, out the gate, that wasn't the only problem. There were problems with the other states, all the different states that had seaports were making trade agreements with different nations so that they could have their own advantages over the things that they needed. The needs of the people in the Carolinas was a lot different than the people in the New England states. And so as we start seeing, you know, things playing out, the Articles of Confederation were dead before the ink dried. And Madison kind of realized that. And to be clear, they didn't in 1787 decide to have a convention. They had been petitioning for years. As a matter of fact, I believe it was in 1784, a year after, they said, we need to have a convention to make some amendments to this, because obviously the few amendments we've had have been shot down by Rhode Island or at least one other person. So the first thing they needed to do is they needed to change the buy-in of what it takes to actually get an amendment, because it was just not right that not, you know, 12 states, as a matter of fact, there were a couple of issues that all 12 states except for Rhode Island agreed with, and they said we're being held back by them. And if you look at how small Rhode Island was, I mean, it's interesting that Rhode Island was just, you know, such a, I'll just say an anarchal, you know, form, or they were just anti-conforming and so forth. They were the last state to ratify. I wouldn't say that they, you know, were leading on anything other than just not conforming. They were the leaders in nonconformance. Anyway, so if I'm insulting anybody from Rhode Island, please contact me and give me some, you know, insights as to how Rhode Island actually did do some leadership and, you know, helped forge the way in the early days of this republic, because, you know, I just don't see it. They, you know, deliberately created a fiat currency so that they could inflate their money's value to where, you know, they basically were able to pay off the debt that they owed the Union, and that money meant nothing. I mean, it was basically giving them just paper. And so as this government evolved, we abandoned all laws that were embedded from the Magna Carta, the Glorious Bill of Rights, and everything under the Court of England. Now, see, here's the problem, folks. If you look at the position of the states at the time of the early Constitution, the establishment of the Constitution, or the establishment of the Revolutionary War, Kentucky, Tennessee, even parts of Ohio, you know, some of the eastern side or western side of the frontier was already being established and being, I'll just say, formed in the likeness of the state that was expanding in that direction. You know, Virginia was Kentucky, and I think Tennessee, the Carolinas, and so North Carolina. And so as we start looking at, you know, what they were doing when they actually said, okay, we've now formed a new government. Did any of the courts, did any of the libraries, did any of these states go and expunge all documents and records that were akin to Britain and Britain's government and laws? No, they didn't. But they should have, because technically they were all expunged. And moving forward, everything was to fall under this new concept of an enumerated constitution, that the people, you were, you know, the sovereigns and created their own sovereigns in governing them. In other words, we had this dual sovereign relationship where we established governments from the counties to the states. So as new states joined the Union, as people started moving into territories. And when a new state qualified to become a member of the Union, and I think the minimum standard was 60,000 people, Christian, English speaking, using our, you know, common law, those types of things. The outlier in the common law era was the state of Louisiana, because the state of Louisiana was developed by the Spaniards and the French, which used civil law. So when they came into the Union, they chose civil law to be their land, or to the law of the land of Louisiana and all of the other states around it, Mississippi, Arkansas, and so forth. These bordering states all chose common law. So as they were evolving and coming into the Union based on these, you know, I won't say tight guidelines, but the Congress had some guidelines. And they required some very specific things. And so when these new states came in, these states were territories. And while they were a territory on their way to becoming a state, finishing the final parameters, county governments were established. And the county governments were established by the people. And then the county, because they had a court and so forth. And so the counties, then when it came time to create the state, the counties had to send delegates, because it's a Republican form of government. They sent delegates to a single point, and they had to decide, you know, where the capital was going to be. You know, the federal government didn't actually dictate all of these types of things in the very beginning. Down the road, they started to dictate. In some ways, some of the states allowed that to happen. In other ways, some of the other states allowed certain things to happen as well. As the federal government started applying some latitude and license, which was not delegated to them. Clearly, what they did was outside the boundaries of the Constitution. Their responsibility, the federal government's responsibility, was to actually admit states into the Union. And so, as we, you know, dive further into this, we want to show you that as every new state came into the Union, every new state was created, their Constitution was created by the county delegates. Which means that the counties at the state level in this union are the parties to the state constitution. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me back up again and go back to this point. When the Constitution, actually, when the Articles of Confederation were created, or the Articles of Association were created in the Confederacy, then the Articles of Confederation, at some point in time, they should have severed all laws that were a part of Britain. Unless they formally adopted those laws as the Articles of Association, and then when the Articles of Confederation came along, they should have severed all of those laws unless they actually integrated or basically allowed. So one of the things you'll notice is the Declaration of Independence was incorporated into the Constitution. I think it was in August of 1789. They didn't incorporate it as the law, but they incorporated it as a founding document that the Constitution was built upon. It doesn't take precedence over the Constitution. It is a historical founding document of the Constitution. But the more important founding documents of the Constitution is the ratification debates. So in other words, the bedrock that the foundation is poured on are the ratification debates, because the ratification debates is where the Constitution was defined and ultimately sold to the states to buy into or to ratify that Constitution. Therefore, every definition, every clause was broken down and defined by the Federalists was a part of an illegal appendage to, like an anchor or a root of that foundation of the Constitution. In other words, they're inseparable. And so I just want to be clear that, you know, when they moved into this Constitution, they established a whole new government and anything that they needed to do, and they actually accounted for all previous treaties and debts that the United States government was going to acknowledge its obligations that were made by the earlier Confederacy, the Articles of Confederation, to ensure and to basically to, you know, help appease or reassure those other governments that, you know, whatever debt we owed, we're still good for. We're going to, you know, honor those debts. Now, they had to actually integrate those things, just like the Northwest Ordinance was created in 1787 in October and passed by Congress, the Continental Congress. That was prior to the Constitution. Was it incorporated as the law of the Constitution? No. It was also brought in as a founding document, as a principle, and or as a guideline. The Constitution superseded, but to be clear, when they started admitting states in the Union, they referred to, and it was integrated as a not as law, but as a reference and or as a, I'll just say, a supporting document for the Constitution. It was not law. The Northwest Ordinance was law, but as the states, as Congress, basically had the ability to legislate very specifically over these things, they didn't use the Northwest Ordinance. They used it as a guide in creating their law. And so, to be clear, you know, there were certain things that were delegated to the federal government. And most people say, well, the Northwest Ordinance forbade the ability to have, you know, any new states join the Union with, that were slave states, that, you know, capped it that way. Well, to be clear, the Constitution didn't empower Congress as the art or as the Northwest Ordinance did. The Northwest Ordinance was a constraint on Congress to keeping that from happening, but the Constitution actually facilitated the states to have their own self-destiny. In other words, this concept of state rights and states, you know, foreordaining the direction that they wanted to go, as long as they were a Republican form of government and they abided by the laws of the Union, that's what mattered. And so when they created the Missouri Compromise, that was a huge, egregious violation of the Constitution. What do I mean by that? Well, the power was never delegated to the federal government to basically inflict slavery upon a state. It's the same thing that the federal government couldn't inflict a loss of land of their state when they came into the Union. See, when they came into the Union, you know, as a territory, all of that land was just free, and it was a part of the territory, and it was going to be a part of the state. Then when the federal government, when the Western states started joining the Union, the federal government said, you know what, we created this thing called the Department of Interior, and we look at this land, you know, they're never going to need this land. We're going to take it from them. And they didn't have the authority to do that. There's nowhere listed or enumerated in the Constitution that the federal government can possess any land like that. Now, they can possess land for forts, docks, shipyards, you know, magazines, you know, military purposes, national security purposes. They can, you know, at the consent of the state, actually, you know, create these things, and then at the needs of the state as well. If the state needs some defenses, such as the southern border needs more defenses, then the federal government's responsible of, you know, taking some of the land of the states and developing a wall or developing security points to ensuring that boundary, because the federal government's responsibility is to protect the sovereignty of each state, which is why in Article 4, Section 4, it states that the United States guarantees to every state in the Union a republican form of government and shall protect each from an invasion. So they had these responsibilities. That was not a power. That was a responsibility, just like bringing states into the Union was a responsibility, not a power. The powers were listed in Article 1, Section 8. The federal government was delegated very specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and property. And if it ain't listed, they can't possess it legally in accordance with the Constitution. Now, they can tell you that they can do this. It's almost like a gang coming in and basically pointing guns at you and saying, we're here for your protection, and we want you to pay us, you know, so much a week so that we can make sure that you don't get robbed. And then the person says, well, I'm not going to do that. Next thing you know, they just, you know, destroy a whole bunch of property in your store. And then they say, we'll be back next week for our first in payment. If not, you know, we'll take it out on your goods. So anyway, that's coercion. That's extortion. That's illegal. But that's what the federal government did. They used money. And they, you know, they convinced states that if they let them do these things, it would be an advantage. So where are we today? We are in a point where we now see people that have dug up out of the annals of old systems and old laws in Kentucky and other states that have, you know, kept these artifacts of an old government, an old, gone, vanquished, and extinct government on American soil, and people are basically resurrecting these things and trying and actually successfully convincing people that this is what you have to do. These, and the term charlatan would come to mind, but these soothsayers are very good at trying and convincing you that this is our heritage and this is our right. We're not Englishmen, folks. You do not have the rights of an Englishman. You have more. You have the rights of an American citizen. You have guaranteed civil rights where Englishmen don't. Englishmen have very few rights. And that's because they have allowed general powers to be granted to their monarch and to their government, which is why their liberty sucks. Fortunately, when it came to enlightenment, the last bastion of enlightenment existed here in America. And as enlightenment started creating, or I should say, as pernicious people started pulling down the curtains in Europe on enlightenment, a dark and dreary view of governing mankind came forth. And that dark and dreary, sorry about that, that dark and dreary government was communism, statism, a new innovation on enslavement. I want to be very clear, folks. Socialism and communism is the new world innovation of slavery, because now people are a part of and are chattel, or basically subjugated to the will of the state. Now, you may have, you know, this awesome opportunity to be able to do things in a, you know, in a communist state, or actually allowed to do certain things if they're okay with it. But I'm here to tell you that when it comes down to your true liberty, whether you're able to do anything or not, when they have the final say, that means you no longer are the sovereigns. When you want to create a business, you want to be able to grow your own food, you want to be able to start, you know, weaving your own, you know, cloth, you want to start cobbling your own shoes. Can you just go do that? No. You have to go to the state and you have to apply, because the states have made a law that you have to basically, you know, file with them. And then some of the states have regulated some of the things and how you can do those things. Like if you're going to sell food, you know, you have to have sanitation measures and so forth. And that's different from one state to the next. Oh, but it's not anymore, because the federal government, who has no enumerated role, responsibility, or power to regulate commerce within the states, they've assumed that power. Teddy Roosevelt was the guy that did that. He created the Department of Labor, Commerce and Labor. And so in so doing, in the early 1900s, and I think it was like 1906 or 7 when he created the department, maybe it was before that, 3 or 4, when he created the Department of Commerce and Labor, he started getting their fingers into the state's business that they didn't have the authority to do. And so the federal government was growing and spending money on things they shouldn't have. We'll be right back after this.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the term, the constitutional term, is usurpation. And before the federal government even created the Department of Commerce and Labor, they already usurped. And I already told you that in 1849, they had created the usurpation of the Department of Home, which we now call the Department of Interior. And in thus usurping this power that was clearly regulated to the states, the federal government did not have this authority to be able to possess land, to be able to identify Indian reservations, parks, recreations, environmental refuges, wetlands, none of that. That power, role, responsibility, and or property is not enumerated in the Constitution. Therefore, it is a usurpation. So, after the beautiful thing I call the 14th Amendment, which ended and would have ended the suffering of freemen, blacks in America, the good old boys decided that they needed to do some other things. And one of the things that they decided, because they were being harassed by the European nations. The European nations were so upset at the fact that the United States government and all states in the Union were not obligated to pay the debt that they paid in trying to undermine the United States. Now, what are you talking about, GR? Well, this beautiful thing I call the 14th Amendment made it so that the southern states, it was in their interest to rejoin the United States. Why? Because right here in Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, it says, the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pension and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. Now, all the southern states, when this thing was ratified, were not in the Union. And the northern states told them, the radical Republicans, these evil guys that everybody wants you to believe, these evil people, who I am telling you, these men who did this were inspired by the divine hand of providence, because this actually put us right back on the right path. And these men actually saved us from the, I'll just say, the minglings, or I should say the intermeddling of Europe. But those people were quickly replaced, or the majority of these radical Republicans were replaced and are coerced into surrendering things that they had no authority to surrender by creating the Organic Act and everything that they did beyond the 14th Amendment, other than some of these other amendments. I mean, when they follow the amendment process, that's legitimate. But when they violate and they regulate law by creating acts. Remember, the Alien and Sedition Acts were not law. They were unconstitutional because the federal government had no authority to do that. The Organic Act, they had no authority to do that. The Civil Rights Act, before the 14th Amendment, the Civil Rights Act, they had no authority. They could not enforce those laws. As a matter of fact, I've got a long bevy of legal cases, even going into the 20th century, where the federal government could not basically create laws for the states. They had no jurisdiction to do. If it was not enumerated in the Constitution, those laws were not applied to the states. So in other words, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 would have only applied to the District of Columbia and the territories, not applicable to states. Which is why the radical Republicans quickly turned into, immediately they started creating and passed within a couple of months the 14th Amendment. Whether you like it or not, because the only people that don't like this, they're not good people in my book. There are a lot of ignorant people that don't like this. But the only people that know this amendment and don't like it are not good people, folks. There's a lot of people that have been completely misled. And as a matter of fact, there was shenanigans in Congress in 1967 by the racist Democrats who didn't like the Civil Rights Act and wanted to basically bring back Jim Crow laws and legalize Jim Crow laws, because if you look at who was doing this in 1967 in Congress, they actually created in the Congressional Record, and if you want a copy, I'm going to put it up on our website, and the copy I'm going to use is what other people use, these people that convince good patriots to become sovereign citizens, they use this big deceptive lie. They say that in 1966, the southern states rejected, in 1867, these southern states were rejecting the 14th Amendment. They weren't rejecting it because they couldn't. They weren't states. They were a part of the Confederacy. They were separate states, and so they were states, but they weren't states in the Union. They didn't have the opportunity. Remember, the radical Republicans, these inspired men by the divine hand of Providence, what everybody calls evil, understood, and that one line, or I should say that one section, section 4, made it so that it was in their best interest. Either that, or they had to deal with Britain and the foreign nations that they were loaning money from to try to win the Civil War, to basically secede from the Union. Because these states couldn't do it on their own. They borrowed a lot of money. And actually, Europe was just smacking their lips and rubbing their grubby mitts together and saying, boy, I can't wait till we get back America, especially Britain. And so when these states, you know, Tennessee was one that quickly ratified it, and it came into the Union when they did. Because that was the requirement if they wanted to join the Union early, because the radical Republican said, this amendment has to be ratified before we'll let you back in the Union unless you're willing to ratify. Now, myself and Paul Venable went through the numbers, and there was only 18 states of the northern states that needed to ratify this amendment. And out of those northern states, 20 states actually ratified the amendment. Now, it's also of record that I think three states tried to unratify. Well, there's no allowance in the Constitution, once you've ratified that, for it to be unratified. The only way an amendment can be rescinded is if the federal government allows it. And so there either has to be language in the Constitution, or I should say in the amendment. There needs to be language in the amendment that at any point in time, a state can actually rescind this amendment. But that language doesn't exist in this or any amendment. When an amendment is applied, it is a permanent application. So the only other time when an amendment can actually and legitimately be rescinded is when the federal government actually allows it. And there's only one time in history that I'm aware of that the federal government allowed the rescission of an amendment to begin. And that was the 17th Amendment, folks. So anybody out there that wants to rescind the 17th Amendment, the door is open for you to do that. But the 14th Amendment was never opened. You can't rescind it. And so these three states that claim, and in the congressional records, they claim that, oh, they unratified it. No, they may have formally done it at the state level, but the federal government did not open that door for them to do that. Once you ring the bell, you can't unring it, period. And that's the nature of the compact. It's the nature of the law. Once you've committed to something, you can't unshake your hand, right? Once the compact is signed, once you've agreed and shook hands on it, it's done. There's no buyer's remorse here. Now, if you feel like the compact is being violated, and everybody has a right to, you know, to say that because the compact is being severely violated. But the alternative of saying, well, we're not going to take this anymore. The alternative is to secede. And if you secede, you have no voice. You have no ability to save America. And so this is why that is not the path we can travel. If we're going to save liberty for the world, we have to save America and our Constitution. It's really that simple. And every person that goes into the sovereign citizen movement and legally follows through this process, they become inept. They are no longer able to help us. They become an inhabitant. They can't vote. They don't pay taxes. And they can't petition government for the redress of grievances, nor do they have any rights under the Constitution. So in other words, if the federal government all of a sudden passed or actually pulled up the Tory Acts and said, you know what, we are integrating the Tory Acts because that was a fundamental law that was a part of this union from the very beginning after the Declaration of Independence, then all inhabitants are subject to removal. All illegal aliens are subject to removal. We can remove everybody. Only U.S. citizens have a guaranteed right and a protection to their property, to, you know, their liberties, everything. It's almost like, you know, when you've accepted Christ, you become a citizen in, you know, his gospel. The only way you can actually remove yourself is to become the apostate or to either be cast out or to divorce yourself and sever that relationship. You can do that. But folks, why? Why would you sever that relationship of these blessed rights that you have under that birthright? It's the same thing as a citizen. Why would you sever these blessings? You become an island that nobody controls you. But you have no control either. We'll be right back after this message.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me just put it on the line here. Every one of you has the agency. In other words, you are sovereign to make your own decisions, and you have the agency to make those types of legal decisions for yourself. But to be clear, to emphasize this, whatever decision you make, there are consequences. Every contract you sign, every covenant you make, there are consequences associated to that. I cannot be any clearer, folks. So when you say, well, I don't like what the government is doing, so I'm going to remove myself from the government. Well, that's a very selfish thing, and what you've done is you've taken yourself out of being able to help the rest of us who actually desire to save liberty and to save the world. If everybody took that path, it would be over, because bottom line, the globalists will win. You go out and you protest. You go out and commit a traffic infraction as an inhabitant. You do not have any rights. The rights of those U.S. citizens that were actually absconded by the federal government for what they did on January 6, 2021 is an absolute and egregious violation of their rights. And they have a leg to stand on because they are U.S. citizens, or those who were. Some of them may have been sovereign citizens. I don't know. But I know all of them weren't. I know many of them were U.S. citizens. Because I've heard some of the interviews of some of these people that have, you know, come out of the court after they have basically did a plea deal to where they had to serve some time and admitted that they were wrong. They were coerced. And the whole process of what the federal government is doing to U.S. citizens is absolutely a violation of their rights. The Patriot Act is an absolute violation of the U.S. Constitution. They do not have the authority to do those things, and they are doing them. And that's only just a small little, you know, that's only happening to less than a hundredth of a percent of the people in the United States are being affected by that. And so they can get away with it because it's not affecting most of the people. It does bother a lot of people, but not enough. And they know the thresholds of how far they can go. You got to remember, this is a very smart baby we created. Because remember, we created, the states and the people created that federal government. And the relationship is parent-child. Right? And if you really look at the overall hierarchy of government, the parent of all government is the county. The state is begotten by the county, and the federal government is begotten by the states. In other words, you know, we the people at the very top who create the counties, and the counties create the states, and the states created the federal government. And the federal government was so well contained and defined that it could not actually expand itself into a, there's no delegation, no granting of power for the federal government to create a permanent political alliance. They can create trade agreements, treaties with trade for commerce purposes, but not for political alliances. Our alliance with the UN is a huge violation. So, folks, we have petitions. Get them. Let us know. We will make the changes for you so that you can take this petition to get us out of the UN and start it in your state, in your county. Actually, we want you to, you have to start in your county, and you deliver these petitions to your county commissioners. Everything goes to your county commissioner because they are the ultimate representative for we the people. They're the ones that are always in session. They're the ones that are always in office. You got to remember, your state legislature is a part-time, it's a two-month-a-year gig. And when your county commissioner tells you that you have to actually go down to your state legislature to complain, no, they don't get it, do they? So, folks, we're actually experiencing this in Wyoming, where these petty monarchs in Campbell County, the princes and princes of the county commission, who believe that they are monarchs, they believe that they're above the law, do not have to address or even receive First Amendment petitions. These guys are fit to be tied. They need help. They need your help. And if you want to help those guys, because I've said this for a long time, we need to start supporting these heroes that are actually out in the streets, out there doing things. And so the Wyoming constitutionalists, Bill Fortner, Larry Williamson, and Jacob, I think Dabney, and there's a few others. Richard, I forget Richard's last name, but nevertheless, and I'm not really good with names, so just be surprised and be proud of me that I could say those names. The fact is, they need your help. They now need to be able to, because they want to go down legal avenues. So they're in this position where they need to go down this legal avenue, but it's occupying them too much. What they need to do, because what's more important, folks, and the essential thing you have to do is create a movement. You have to get the people in the county to get behind you in supporting the law of the land and demanding that public servants be held accountable to it. And so the whole point, this is why we talk about Martin Luther, the whole point is we have to educate them so that they realize that these guys are violating the law. And because most Americans, when they realize that their public servants are doing things that they have no authority to do, that they're directly violating the Constitution, the supreme law of the land, then they don't like that. And it actually gets into their craw and gets, you know, under their skin to a point where they become irritated and willing to make change. America doesn't like bullies and they don't like tyrants. And tyrants in political offices that tell you that they're above the law, that they don't have to answer to you, that they don't have to suffer, you know, your little whims and wants. Well, then you have to create the movement. You have to get everybody in that county. So they need help. They could really use some help. And if you, I'll talk to them. And one of the things I want to do is I want to plug, and that maybe they should create a GoFundMe or some social type of funding so that they can get some support. If you know a lawyer that can actually practice law that really wants to cut their teeth, just imagine this. How would you love to have, you know, a guaranteed win? Because I'm telling you, this is a guaranteed win. Who, whatever lawyer goes in and actually, you know, takes on this battle will be winning. Whether they win in court or not, the American people will see this lawyer. Where's what's her name? Sydney or whatever, you know, where are these lawyers that were kind of gravitating towards Trump that actually, you know, just flopped? I mean, nobody won any of their cases, you know, but they were out there telling you they were doing this and so forth, but they didn't even win. And when I mean they didn't even win, they didn't even win the hearts and minds of the people, because it's not like the federal court has a dog in that fight. Only the state courts do when it comes to elections. And that's why this one case in Carolina actually may turn a lot of heads, because states do have the authority. The state legislatures have the authority over elections. It's in the Constitution, folks. And the court system can't be caught, you know, breaching that, because the court system is actually beholden to Congress. So if the court actually starts breaching and doing those things, now, even if it benefits Congress, they will allow it to happen. But if it actually is the right thing, Congress can't stop it. So this is why I think that Carolina course is, that Carolina case is pretty big. But back to these guys. Any lawyer that goes into this county and actually give, you know, serves these people notice and has these people removed, because that's where they stand. Every single one of these councilmen or council people or commissioners, I should say, these commissioners all stand in jeopardy of being immediately removed and creating a governmental crisis at the county level, where they would have to have an immediate election or at least have appointments until they could have an immediate election. And that's what would happen. The governor would then make appointments to the county commissioners. And so it's kind of interesting, folks. These are the things in play. And I'm telling you that the shot heard around the world is coming from Campbell County, Wyoming. There are shots that are being fired in South Dakota. I'm working right now on a legal brief to talk about digital currency. Because right now there are many states. See, I was asked earlier by Woody about this new CDB or CBDC or whatever, this new digital currency that, you know, they're floating around. They're not just floating it around. They're actually have this in state legislatures where the states are actually trying to pass these laws. And so right now I'm creating a legal brief that shuts this down, because it's against the Constitution for states to pass a law like this. So we're here actually fighting the fight. We need your help. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. And as I said, and as I beg, we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities,
responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.